things. No? Okay, so let's start session one, which is history. Is that okay for now? Yeah.
Thank you. So just to reiterate, Laura and Sharon, thanks for coming today. It's a really fantastic opportunity to be able to discuss these issues, both in terms of contemporary and also historical setting. I just want to take 15 minutes or so to introduce this session and to kind of try and situate you with a little bit of kind of context for the 1970s and debates around race and education at this time before we embark looking at primary source material, which will then structure and shape our discussions for the majority of this session. One of the questions I think that was at the forefront of our discussions when we were coming up with today was to think about the ways in which understanding anti-racism and the demands that that movement makes upon educational structures are historically rooted, that they are shaped by the specific context at the time. But that also, in many contemporary debates, we don't necessarily see the ways in which reverberations from earlier debates around this, particularly in secondary education, are now informing discussions to do with higher education. So we wanted to use this session to start to think about how we might look at some of the discussions and quite antagonistic confrontations that were emerging in the 70s and 80s around anti-racist education to illuminate some of those enduring themes and reverberations. One of the things I think that comes through really clearly is that anti-racism is interpreted in vast different ways by different groups, and that is true today just as it was true in the 70s and 80s. And again, trying to pick apart the way in which this sort of bigger movement is stitched together helps to explain why certain themes are pursued and others left by the wayside. I appreciate that we all come from different disciplinary backgrounds. Some of us have enjoyed the vagaries of the British education system through secondary school, others haven't. So just to kind of give you a bit of context in terms of this very confused system in the 1970s. British secondary education underwent a fundamental restructuring in the aftermath of the Second World War. So before 1939, depending on where you lived in the country, about between 10 and 20% of 11-year-olds progressed to a specialist secondary school. The rest would remain elementary schools until the age of 13, 14, and then enter the labour market. The 1944 Education Act, the Butler Act, fundamentally changed this. From this point forward, all 11-year-olds would proceed to a secondary school and have a free, universal secondary education by the state, or be entitled to that. This system from the late 40s, well, from the 1940s through to the late 1960s, was structured around what was described as around the tripartite or bipartite system. So most children, most 11-year-olds, either went to a grammar school, which was designed for the top 25% or so. The rest, the remaining three quarters, went to a secondary model. And the entry mechanism at this point was the 11+. So an academic exam decided where you would proceed to for your secondary education. Now, unsurprisingly, the majority of parents started to realise quite quickly that this failed to deliver on the promises of equality of opportunity that 1944 had seemed to usher in. And by the late 1950s, we see significant pushback from parents demanding a fairer system and the removal of the 11+. And from this point forward, local education authorities, so the local authorities are responsible for organising education in a specific area, start to experiment with new forms of secondary school. And now, these could take a variety of forms, but broadly speaking, they start to do away with selection at 11. And this is what we can kind of conceive of as a comprehensive system. In 1965, this is endorsed by the Labour government at a national level, and they start to encourage LEAs, don't force them, but they encourage LEAs to develop plans to restructure schooling along comprehensive lines. So this brings us to the 1970s. And the 1970s is a key decade in the chronology of comprehensivisation, because as you can see from these figures, this is when the majority of children move to comprehensive schools. So at the start of the 70s, around a third of children are in comprehensives. By the end of the decade, over 90%, so over 3 million kids, are in comprehensive schools. This is also the decade, so it, on one hand, British secondary schooling becomes comprehensive in the 1970s, it also becomes multiracial and multi-ethnic in the 1970s as well. This is the decade in which a generation of children of Windrush migrants start to make the transition into secondary education. And these two processes intersect in ways which create fierce debates around questions of equality, of citizenship, of national identity, and start to inflame incredibly politicised questions on both sides of the debate that around the rights of all children to have equality of education, the right to be to benefit from the structure of the welfare state, and whether in fact, as some of the critics would suggest, that wasn't actually the case for those who didn't fit into a particular conception of British national identity. In many ways, this is a distinctly local story. So as you can see from the maps, the majority of children who were classified as immigrant pupils by the state up until the mid-70s were concentrated in relatively few largely urban areas. In London has over 50% of children who fall into this category, certainly through to the late 70s, early 80s. In this respect, we need to think about the local histories that underpin the sources we will look at. The LEAs have a vast amount of responsibility to shape curriculum, to shape local structures of education, and that they do that according to how they perceive local needs. But at the same time, we need to be very careful not to lose sight of how these local histories connect to wider national and global histories. But this is a process that takes place against the backdrop of decolonisation, of civil rights and black power movement in a kind of transatlantic context, and that these are constantly informing the ways in which communities of colour are thinking about these questions of access to education in this period. From the early 70s then, debates around race and education take on an extra urgency and edge. And this is framed largely in the context of Powellism, Rivers of Blood, a speech given by Powell in 69 directly references schools and the question of what the implications of immigration from the new Commonwealth, particularly kind of race being put at the heart of this, what the implications that are for the education system, what the implications are for national identity. Discourses around and panics around immigration again accelerate in the 1970s in the context of the South Asian move from East African countries, and again against the context of a stuttering economy. And at this point we start to see a real kind of kick in terms of how this appears in the press, how this is being driving forms of community activism. Importantly, and this is a crucial point to make, that these are debates which are not shaped purely by external forces putting these on to communities of colour in the UK. This is a period at which those communities start to organise and resist the forms of exploitation, of stereotyping, of inequality, which have characterised the structures of the welfare state up until this point. And in that sense, we need to think about the 1970s as a decade as well, where a generation of migrants or immigrants, as they've been characterised by others, start to make their demands as black Britons. And that this is an essential process of citizenship and a way in which education becomes a means through which you claim your rights. Three key themes shape debates around race and education in the 1970s. The study published by Bernard Cord in 1971 highlights the ways in which forms of systemic discrimination affect, or disproportionately affect, students of colour in the school system. And Cord's interest is in the ways in which pupils of colour get labelled as educationally subnormal at a disproportionately higher rate than white counterparts. And the question he asks is, what are the structural inequalities that are driving this? He dismisses that IQ has anything to do with it. And again, this is one of the first times really that we see black activists gaining national attention in making these arguments. He denies that IQ has anything to do with it, and therefore asks, what is it about the system that is shaping these structures of inequality? And Court's answer is that there are strategies used by schools which explicitly discriminate against pupils of colour, and at the same time, in so doing, work to alienate them from their racial identity in ways which undermines their self-esteem, self-concept, and creates structures of inequality that are very hard to get past if you merely concentrate on prejudice on day-to-day levels. So this kind of the one critique then is this emergence of systemic discrimination. The state picks up on this, but they largely ignore the structural side and instead start to fixate upon prejudice as an individual behaviour. We'll see that when we talk about multiculturalism. The second theme, which is running throughout the 1970s, is the growth in activity of the National Front and explicit forms of racialised violence in everyday settings. You can see from this photo that the National Front are using schools as spaces in which they promote their activities. This is a National Front meeting in a primary school classroom, that's how it happens. They are distributing literature at school gates. Teachers are complaining about National Front graffiti being all over school toilets and desks and lockers. And in this sense, there's a growing demand from across the political community, so from the radical left, from a sort of liberal establishment perspective, and the black community, that more is done to challenge this type of far-right violence. Thirdly, we start to see the shift in the way in which black activists and black intellectuals are framing this debate, drawing on the strands of radical sociology of the 1960s, the radical social movements of that decade too, and the global context of black power. Black intellectuals start to form a critique of education that focuses upon structure rather than behaviour. And then instead of saying that racism can be solved by making individuals behave in a more tolerant fashion, they emphasise that the British state is constructed along a fundamentally racist lines. That the combination of schools, of the police, of the criminal justice system, of the welfare state, fundamentally privileges white inhabitants at the expense of communities of colour. And forming this critique, they highlight the ways in which young, particularly African-Caribbean, men are persecuted by the state. They identify rising rates of unemployment, again, which are disproportionately worse in communities of colour. And they use this as a way of saying that the fundamental problem that we see is a nexus which is built around modern capitalism. And that without challenging that base structure, there is no way that racism can be dealt with within it. This informs then two divergent, although overlapping, responses in the 1970s, and that critics and advocates of both tend to exaggerate the differences in ways that kind of emphasise their perspective, but there are two very clearly different priorities. So on the one hand, we have multicultural education, which becomes the response of what we might describe as a liberal establishment, that the state starts to realise the need to reform and to change the ways in which pupils of colour are taught in schools, the particular focus upon the curriculum, the need to raise self-esteem amongst pupils of colour. So again, by educating them in their own culture, as that is, however that is defined, and largely is defined by external voices in government, this will help them become more successful at schools, better citizens. At the same time, education of white and working class, again, is this intersection of class and race is crucial here, of white working class peoples will help them become more tolerant, less racist, and better citizens. The key is that multiculturalism and focusing upon the individual, or individual behaviour as a means of addressing racial inequality. It largely ignores the structural side. This is quickly caricatured by its critics. Quickly caricatured by its critics as essentially sorry samosas and steel drums. And that in focusing on these superficial elements, it does little to address the underlying structural critique. And the demand to challenge that comes from the anti-racist movement, which we'll look at in more detail. Anti-racist movement is, again, it's a fairly broad church of opinion. There are different emphases and goals amongst different groups within that movement. But its fundamental message is that racism requires an active opposition. And in taking an active opposition, it requires structural reform. It requires a fundamental rethinking of the ways in which education is provided to all pupils. So this is not merely identifying pupils of colour as a problem to be solved. It is understanding that racism is the problem that has to be corrected within British society. You can see here that the photo here is of a funeral of Blair Peach, who was a teacher and anti-racist activist who was killed by the police in the late 70s in Southall. And again, you can see that this is a movement which is diverse in terms of its those who are involved in it, but that we also start to see that that creates fissures and fractures as the 1980s progress. And particularly as these groups are being expected to apply for funding from local authorities, often in competition with one another. The fundamental point, then, just to kind of finish on before we move on to the sources, and we'll pass on to Laura to talk a little bit more about the sources, is to say that anti-racism is self-conscious and radical. It demands that there is a fundamental challenge to the structural inequality that exists at the heart of British society. It dismisses the idea that individuals alone can take on racism. And that in fact, without rethinking the ways in which the institutions of state are organised and enacted, there is no possibility of actually challenging the structures of discrimination that exist. The case studies we're going to look at will focus on London. It's important to stress that this is a movement that is happening across the country, and some of the sources you'll see come from the southwest as well. But I will pass it to Laura to talk a bit more about
Thanks. I don't have any slides, and that's actually a really helpful map for you to end on. Thank you. So we wanted the kind of source exercise we're going to do to have a bit more focus than the kind of whole national context. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of zoom in on an historical case study of the Inner London Education Authority, so that those Inner London boroughs represented there, kind of old Inner London boroughs in red, known as ILEA, in the 1980s. So kind of thinking about that context Chris has laid out for the 1970s, and we'll kind of move in to think about the 1980s with our sources mostly. But I'm going to start by just giving you a bit of context on ILEA, and then you're already in groups because we had the tables laid out that way, split up into groups and give you some primary sources to look at relating to this case study and a few more broadly the context Chris has outlined. So during the 1980s, not only is the population more diverse, but more and more pupils of colour and girls are kind of staying on at school beyond the minimum school leaving age of 16. The school leaving age went up to 16 in 1972, so in the 80s more and more people are choosing to stay on at school longer, right? And they're also therefore sitting external school leaving examinations. The GCSE, which you know now is the kind of standard 16 examination, doesn't come in until 1986, so before that there is two different options you can do: O-levels, which are the more elite academic qualifications, but also CSEs, which I'll talk about a bit more, but are a qualification that's brought in to serve this kind of widening participation in secondary education cohort. But you can already see there a bit of a bipartite split that emerges as to who gets access to which kinds of qualifications, and therefore what power they have on the labour market. So in response to all these changes, the ILEA educationists, who we'll kind of look at a bit in the sources, focused on embedding anti-racist and anti-sexist pedagogy in London schools, seeing largely that just diversifying curricula had made little difference in the past to either educational experience or outcomes. So the kind of ILEA movement we're going to be thinking about is responding to some of the criticisms already laid out from black activists that Chris has outlined, but it's also kind of, it's still a largely white-led establishment movement, so it still attracts some of those same criticisms, doesn't quite get it right. And I think it's also, as we'll see in the sources, important to mention that within ILEA, anti-racism was largely driven by a group of feminists, so it came out of anti-sexist work, but these two things were incredibly interlinked, and it was thinking intersectionally across class, race, and gender. So the ILEA did do a lot of good work in promoting anti-racist and anti-sexist work in schools, but it also attracted significant backlash. So in a climate of populism and Thatcherite ascendancy, this came, of course, from right-wing critics arguing for a return to traditional values in schools and the protection of individual freedoms. But it also came from BME community groups who felt that this anti-racist work, as performed in mainstream schools, often failed to make the necessary links to the deep structural inequalities facing pupils of colour that, as Chris has already outlined, became key in the 1970s to the broader black intellectual and radical movement. And now we've chosen this case study of ILEA because I think it does present some interesting parallels. Just like the UK university sector today, ILEA was responding to trends in widening educational participation, recognising that identity of race, class and gender were intersectional for young people in their classrooms. So we hope that understanding how and why these progressive practices and policies were championed and challenged in the past might help us think about the present. So on ILEA, ILEA was the education branch, the kind of education section authority of the Greater London Council. It was inaugurated in 1965, so that same year that Chris mentioned that comprehensive schools become fully backed nationally by the Labour government. and the ILEA was the main educational body for the 12 inner London boroughs and the City of London. The ILEA consisted of 48 members, a combination of GLC councillors and borough representatives. In 1981, kind of key context, Labour took the GLC under the leadership of Redken Livingston. That's not his actual official name. Redken Livingston. And with that came a kind of radical equal opportunities policy. So that's capital E, capital O, ILEA equal opportunities policies, really focused on tackling discrimination against girls and ethnic minority children. Now, I think although this kind of idea of equal opportunities, small e, small o, had underpinned some of the critiques of the grammar schools that Chris had talked about in this kind of post-war discourse of meritocracy, in the 1980s, this phrase assumed a new politically concentrated meaning, reflecting decades of backlash against the failure of meritocracy. So in the ILEA context, equal opportunities could also start to encompass quite sharp critiques of policies of the 60s and 70s, notably for our context, co-education and multicultural education. So these policies that were kind of hailed as the kind of liberal, forward-looking policies in education in the 60s start to be challenged in the 1980s in this new kind of discourse of equal opportunities. So what did equal opportunities actually mean for inner London schools? So ILEA appointed its first equal opportunities inspectorate in 1983, so they're kind of equivalent of Ofsted now, and that scattered advisory teachers throughout London secondary schools and held schools accountable to adhering to the equal opportunities mission. The advisory teachers, their role, and we'll hear from them in some of the sources, connected schools and teachers to newly built resource learning centres, and they were charged with producing specific training days for different subjects, and written guidance and context for use in the classroom. So there was quite a lot of infrastructure around ILEA equal opportunities policy. All schools were obliged to abide by ILEA's anti-sexist and anti-racist policies, and we're going to look at some policy statements in the source exercise. To give you a bit of background on these policies, to think of them in the context of kind of the theories of educational sociology at the time, so they were kind of underpinned by this dominant idea of the informal curriculum, which is a concept that educational sociologists had coined in the 1970s through ethnographic work in secondary schools. I'm looking at Sharon here in case I make any mistakes on the educational sociology side. So they argued that this informal curriculum operated through social interactions, language and behaviour, including and especially by teachers, which entrenched whiteness and male superiority. So ILEA teachers were counselled, for example, not to praise or blame pupils in ways which highlighted their sex, for example, saying things like, well done, girls aren't normally good at that, nor should they interact with their pupils in ways that impose stereotypes on pupils of colour, such as assuming, for example, that Asian girls are more passive than their white peers. So anti-racist and anti-sexist policies in ILEA were designed to launch a double attack on the content and method of teaching young people. So it wasn't just, this movement was not just about curriculum, but it was about how subjects were taught. It was about pedagogy, which I think is kind of what we're talking about today fundamentally. Since the mid-1960s, some groups of ethnic minority children had been underperforming in school leaving examinations, and ILEA was kind of tuned into these metrics. So in 1978 to 1979, a survey of six LEAs, and this is nationally, LEAs that covered approximately half all the school leavers in England, it found that in all age 16 school leaving exams, only 3% of African Caribbean children obtained 5 or more higher grades, compared with 18% of Asian pupils and 16% of the total cohort of leavers in these LEAs. So it's very clear that it's that the African Caribbean pupils who are underperforming. And although these figures indicate a divergence between different groups, other official inquiries found that pupils from all non-white backgrounds were being actively deterred from even accessing the most elite secondary qualifications of O-levels and A-levels. So you know I mentioned earlier that O-levels were the qualification that would lead to A-levels and potentially university, but not even so much that, you know, in the early 1980s they would lead you to kind of good apprenticeships, professional, entry-level professional jobs. And the CSEs were kind of catching up, but they were not seen as most prestigious. So they were finding that within the schools there was this racially informed streaming and setting, and school cultures that enabled subtle forms of everyday discrimination. Now, London, as the capital and as home to many of these peoples, was, as always, a flashpoint around these issues. And again, we'll look at this in some examples in the source exercises. So progressive teachers and educators increasingly argued that exam criteria must adapt, for example, to the linguistic needs and cultural assumptions of immigrant children, some of whom might have arrived in the UK with little English and accumulated more disadvantage the further into the education system that they progressed. So here we kind of start to see some attempts to challenge those structures that were not served by the kind of multicultural education approach. Another important report in 1980, Ilya published research on the literacy of African Caribbean children in the inner London schools, which highlighted that reading levels for this group remained below average at school leaving age. So thinking as well about the accumulation of disadvantage across the kind of educational life course is really important. So a general awareness of these cumulative structural issues meant that anti-racist policy in ILEA was never just about celebrating multiculturalism, although this lingered. It was focused on academic underachievement and aimed at forging a new pedagogy that could deliver fairer educational outcomes to young people of colour. And we must remember this task was tackled with greater urgency by the London left in the 1980s, against a broader background of Thatcherite education policy that kind of emphasised standards, discipline and parental choice. And often these forces kind of work against one another as ILEA is trying to, or certain groups within ILEA are trying to impose these anti-sexist and anti-racist policies. It seems to be directly in conflict with this idea of greater parental choice that is guiding the education system from the 1980s. So of course, ILEA's equal opportunities mission attracted critiques, not just from Labour's political opponents and the right-wing press, but also from many teachers and head teachers in the ILEA schools who enjoyed a significant amount of autonomy within England's uniquely devolved education system. So again, it's important to remember that before 1988, there was no national curriculum, so there is a lot of power within individual schools and even individual classrooms to decide kind of what is taught. And although ILEA is obviously on the kind of more progressive radical side of the education authorities, there's also a lot of teachers teaching within these thousands of schools who have been there for a long time, who might not necessarily be as signed on to some of these policies. So there is, of course, some infighting. So anyway, we'll see in some of the sources to follow how anti-racist, anti-sexist policies were both opposed politically, but also more subtly undermined at school level by teachers, by people working within institutions. So, for example, one of the sources talks about how one London head teacher claimed that he would like to implement anti-sexist policies in his schools, but he couldn't really because he didn't want to upset Asian parents. So this is a theme that reoccurs with white teachers and educational administrators often assuming the right to speak for parents of colour and using their own cultural stereotypes to justify not tackling the roots of that educational disadvantage. So what we've done is we've prepared a series of source packs, or more accurately, Chris has prepared a series of source packs, which include extracts from articles, policy statements, young people's writing, statistics, and visual material. This might at first seem to you like a GCSE history source exercise. I don't know if that appeals, but we wanted you to see the kind of primary source material and have a conversation about it rather than us just digesting it and summarising it for you. These sources are designed to get us thinking and talking about how racist and anti-racist education has worked and not worked in the past. I think that the sources all have some common sources and all some different sources, and they're organised around themes, which we'll go through in just a moment. And we're just going to keep you in the groups that you're in, I think. You can take some time to read the sources individually or discuss them. They're quite short. And we've got about 30 minutes, basically, for you to read and discuss them in your breakout groups. And then we'll feed back in a plenary session so we can all hear from each other about the different themes that you had on your table. And maybe we'll try and take some notes to draw out any important points. Okay, so you're already organised into groups, unless you want to change. Is there any here, Chris, or have you got them all?
I'm Sarah.
And I'm Maria.
I'm Joe.
Hi, Joe. I'm doing some more explaining.